For years, I just dreaded going to the dentist. But at Advanced Dentistry, I don't have to.
First and foremost, they want you to feel comfortable when you walk in. Like, you'll feel it. Whereas in the past, I might have gone into the dentist and thinking, I might feel some pain at some point. But with IV sedation, it can be something that you don't dread.
If you've been avoiding the dentist because of fear, worry, or just not wanting to be judged, you're not alone. Visit nofeardentist.com to learn how IV sedation can change your life.
Freakonomics Radio is sponsored by Cars.com. Have you heard about the Your Garage feature on Cars.com? Here's how it works. You add your car to your garage to track its market value and cash in when the time is right to sell. Track both your car's historical and projected value. When it's time to sell, easily secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with Your Garage on Cars.com.
It's the sensation you've been hearing about.
That's right.
Prize-linked savings is here. Open a savings account now for as little as $25, and you could walk away
with $100,000.
It's the no-lose lottery. That's right. Cash prizes
are waiting for you.
Save now and win bigger. Call now and cash in. For a limited time, void where prohibited.
In the last episode of this podcast, we started to tell you about a new idea, a new financial instrument that takes advantage of one of America's favorite pastimes, gambling.
So 2 out of 3 American adults report gambling, and it's 50% say they play lottery. The next closest is casino, which is, you know, about 1 in 5 adults.
Ah, the lottery. We love it. For a couple of bucks, you buy the chance to change your life. This asymmetry is called skewness, and it generates hope, irrational hope to be sure, and too much of it, for that life-changing payout. We feed that hope by buying lots and lots of lottery tickets, about $60 billion worth a year, most of which is essentially poured down a big hole. And the people who pour the most are the ones who can least afford it, the people who don't make much money to start with and who generally don't manage to save any money. So, what if you could attach the thrill of skewness to the boring old prospect of saving money instead of pouring it down that hole? This is already happening in 20 countries around the world. It's called a prize-linked savings account, or PLS. Some people think the idea is ripe for transplanting to the U.S. Just one problem. It's illegal. Why? Well, because legally, a PLS plan is a lottery. And the only lotteries allowed in the U.S. are the lotteries run by the states themselves. But there's a chink in that monopolistic armor. In Michigan, a small group of credit unions has taken advantage of a loophole in state law to set up a PLS program they call Save to Win. Here's its first big winner, 87-year-old Billy June Smith. So you put $75 of your own money into a credit union savings account.
Right.
And as a result, you were entered into a lottery for which you won $100,000.
Right.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. What do you think?
Well, it is. It has helped me a lot.
Now, tell me what you've done with the money, Billy.
Well, I've had to replace the furnace just a month ago. And I've put in water softener. And I have put my money aside for the taxes. And I do have another savings that I don't touch for just so long. And I can add to it then.
From American Public Media and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio. Today, part 2 of the No-Lose Lottery, why state lotteries and the mighty U.S. Treasury Department don't want you to put your money into a savings account. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Prize-linked savings, or PLS, accounts have a long history. In the U.K., the government-run premium bond program has been around for decades. Every month, it pays a top lottery prize of £1 million. A few years ago, a bank in South Africa started a PLS program that was hugely successful. So much so that the National Lotteries Board of South Africa sued to have it shut down. It's hard for anyone but the government to run a lottery when the government thinks the only lottery should be run by the government itself. And that's the biggest obstacle to bringing PLS plans to the U.S. The biggest lottery in this country is run by New York State. Gordon Medenica, the state lottery director, says that 75% of New Yorkers play, which generates $7 billion in annual sales. But in order to get there, New York, like most states that have a lottery, had to rewrite its existing laws that prohibited any kind of gambling.
New York first began in 1967, and it was the second state after New Hampshire to come in.
What was the original impetus? Was it a budget shortfall, essentially? Did the state feel we need money? We can void this ban on gambling in the state and come up with a way to do it?
I think it was both a desire to raise money, and also I think it was a recognition that playing was going on anyway. And it was an attempt to tax and regulate an activity that they knew was very common among citizens. And, you know, whether you go back to the numbers games that existed in urban areas and quite frankly still exist, or those kinds of activities, and even sports betting today, which of course technically is illegal, but we all know is a huge business. And I think there was a recognition on the part of lawmakers that, much like prohibition, better to tax and regulate than to, ostensibly call something illegal and pretend it doesn't go on.
State governments do more than tax and regulate their lotteries. They take a big cut for themselves. Now, in gambling circles, the commission, taken by whoever operates the game, is known as the rake. With state lotteries, the rake can be as high as 60%. That means that as little as 40% of the money taken in from ticket sales ends up in the pool that pays the winners. The rest of the money usually goes to education and to cover overhead, marketing, and sales commissions. Now, compare the lottery's rake to the slot machines in a casino. They pay out more than 90%.
It's a lot of money they take off.
Here's Melissa Carney, an economist at the University of Maryland who studies lottery gambling.
States ostensibly run the lottery, to at least initially it was, let's provide an alternative legal lottery product or numbers product, right, to the illegal groups. It'll be transparent. It won't be corrupt. But then they declare themselves monopolies and they take a big cut, which is, we can think that's a really high price, right? Consumers are paying a very high price to buy this type of product. They can't get it from anywhere else legally. And then they have the lottery commissions have the mandate to increase revenue. So they innovate, they advertise, they market. They sort of behave like monopolists.
What do we know about people who play the lottery? What's, for instance, the socioeconomic breakdown?
Okay, so this surprises a lot of people, but people throughout the socioeconomic distribution play the state lotteries. And so it's, roughly 50 to 60% of men, roughly 50 to 60% of women, roughly 50 to 60% of people across the education spectrum. So people with, high school dropouts, high school degree, college graduates. And when you look at the absolute dollars reported spending, it's not that different across the income distribution. So sort of lower income households spend about as much in dollar terms as higher income households. The flip side of that, of course, is that it winds up being a larger share of lower income households' total spending.
So states have a monopoly on lotteries, and the people who can least afford to play buy just as many tickets as people who make a lot more money. That's why scholars like Carney and Peter Tufano at the Harvard Business School think that prize-linked savings plans could help America's pathetic savings rate. So why hasn't the idea gained more traction here? According to Tufano, the main culprit is history.
I think the reason that this product exists elsewhere and not here is because of the, I don't want to say accidents of history, but the path that history has taken in America over a long period of time. I'm not a banking expert, nor am I a lawyer, but it's been explained to me that the prohibitions on banks engaging in lottery activities goes back to the 1930s when, for whatever reason, the activities that some banks pursued made regulators very nervous about them having anything to do with the lottery, which is why you can't walk into a bank and buy a lottery ticket. And so that may have been a really smart legislation back then, and it may still be smart legislation now, but it seemed to have, in this instance, thrown out not only lotteries, but also savings programs that have chance elements to it. So that's half of the equation. The other half of the equation is that as a public finance matter, American states and localities have relied on lotteries as a way to close public finance deficits. There are other ways to close those deficits, and unfortunately, they're going to be quite large, I suppose, looking in the future. But when public entities were given the right to use this vehicle to raise funds, other parties were prohibited from using the same vehicle, and therefore there are prohibitions against private parties running lotteries in virtually every state. So the combination of laws to try to protect, I suppose, the safety and soundness of banks and laws to permit states and local governments to have a kind of preferential access to this form of funding has led to the situation where I think this product, which no one ever meant to outlaw, has become outlawed.
Outlawed. Coming up, we run the prize-linked savings idea past a couple of state lottery commissioners. They are not enthusiastic. And we bring it to the U.S. Treasury Department. They don't like it so much either.
Freakonomics Radio is sponsored by Canva. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Magic Write in Canva Docs. You can just describe what you want to say in a few words, and Magic Write will generate a draft in seconds. You can use it for sales proposals, marketing plans, job descriptions, meeting agendas, you name it. Tweak your draft and you're done. It is a serious time saver and the perfect way to beat the blank page. Generate your draft with Canva Docs at canva.com. Designed for work. Freakonomics Radio is sponsored by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and over 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx. Freakonomics Radio is sponsored by Fidelity. With Fidelity Active ETFs, the investing potential is in the name, active. Because instead of just riding the index, Fidelity Active ETFs seek to outperform it with an expert team working behind the scenes. Fueled by industry-leading expertise and robust research capabilities, Fidelity Active ETFs shift with the markets, pursue upside potential, and adapt to volatility. And while you can get the potential outperformance of an actively managed fund, you can still buy and sell it on your terms just like any other ETF. Take a more, well, active approach with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC. It makes sense that a state-run lottery might see a prize-linked savings plan as a natural rival. But the New York State Lottery, for a little while at least, actually considered teaming up with Harvard's Peter Tufano
on a PLS plan. Here's Gordon Medenica again from the New York State Lottery.
We called it a no-lose lottery ticket. And basically what the concept is that you buy a ticket, and it would be an expensive ticket, let's say $100, but you can never lose the base of it. And then we pool those funds, invest them, just like a mutual fund or anything else like that. And then the investment gains become the prize pools. And then every month or so, instead of earning almost 0% on a savings account, there's a lottery, and different account holders win prizes just like you would with a lottery game. So we went through a lot of this research, and we presented to the FDIC. And this was an FDIC committee on trying to encourage a higher savings rate among low-income people, and also to embrace what they refer to as the unbanked, and to get low-income people to use banking facilities and financial services better.
Medenica says he couldn't make the math work for the New York State Lottery. But for the Florida Lottery, it's not about the math. It's about the law. I asked Leo DiBonino, the Florida Lottery Secretary, what he thought about a prize-linked savings plan.
From a purely lottery perspective, I think the Florida Lottery is the only entity in Florida that can operate a lottery game. So if what you described is legally a lottery game, then I've got to say that it probably sounds illegal under current Florida law.
States protect their lotteries because the lotteries bring in lots of money for the states. Some money goes to education and other worthy-seeming causes. But even DiBonino admits that's not what motivates people to play.
I think people, Floridians in general, are players. They like the idea that that the money they spend on the lottery, that a portion of it, and in this case a significant portion, does go to fund education. But I'm the first to say that they don't play the lottery by and large to help fund education in Florida. People play the lottery to win. They like the prizes. They like the excitement. They like the fun, the possibility of winning, you know, sometimes $10, $20, $50, and sometimes many multi-millions of dollars. I think the funding to education is ancillary. It's an extra bonus that the public views the lottery as a different and unique and fun way to be able to fund at least some of the things that our education system needs.
The lottery has famously been called a tax on the stupid. You get terrible odds, and the state rakes off a huge amount, converting your hard-earned cash into an additional school's tax. Now, you can understand why a state lottery commissioner like Leo DiBonino of Florida likes things just the way they are. But what about the other government officials who work on things like consumer protection? What about someone like the Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions at the U.S. Treasury Department? His name is Michael Barr. We talked to him a few weeks ago. He's since stepped down. I doubt it had anything to do with our interview. And I asked Barr if he ever played the lottery.
I haven't really played the lottery. I think probably if I went back over my 45 years, I may have bought a scratch ticket or two in my 20s.
Now, why do you not play the lottery?
It's a fool's errand. As you undoubtedly know, there are a handful of people who will make some money out of the lottery, but most people most of the time will lose money. It's not a great way of spending one's scarce resources.
I don't know if you're aware of the pilot program that's been happening up in Michigan with the 8 credit unions, where a prize-linked savings program is actually underway. The first lottery-type payout of $100,000 was awarded this year. Are you familiar at all with that? It's called the Save to Win program?
I have not actually studied that.
So the folks who are trying to make this happen come up against a very simple reality, which is that it's typically illegal, that a private institution like a bank or a credit union is not allowed to run a lottery according to state law, that state law typically forbids gambling, and in order to allow a state, let's say, to run a lottery itself, there's a loophole that must be written, and those loopholes have been written. Most states do have their own lotteries, but for someone else to come in and do it, it would be illegal. If you looked at the landscape and thought, in my role as in Treasury here, I would like to encourage people to save more. I'd like to make it worthwhile for them to save more, and I'd like to remove barriers that prevent them from participating in projects that let them save more. Would you be in favor of sponsoring or trying to get rolling some legislation that would allow for a widespread deployment of prize-linked savings? Do you think that's something that Treasury should get its momentum behind?
One of the things that I've learned in my role at Treasury is that picking fights that one doesn't have to pick is not the wisest course of action unless it's something that's absolutely essential to take on. And I wouldn't have put that in the category of high priorities to wage into a discussion of state gaming law.
But if your job is to help American families save more and be better financial stewards generally, and we know that tens of billions of dollars are being spent on lottery tickets every year, which you called a fool's game, and one alternative is to offer bank savings accounts whereby a customer can put in $100, enter a lottery, maybe win, probably not, but maybe, and keep the $100, why isn't that something that's worth considering even in a politically fractious environment when the potential benefit, getting people to save more, seems to be much larger than the potential downside of angering some state lottery commissioners, let's say?
I think there are lots of different ways of encouraging greater savings among all American families, and I think we should continue to innovate and to try new approaches. I think that the question that you posed is potentially one aspect of one way to do that. I don't think we yet know enough from the research to say it's the kind of thing that we think needs to happen on a wide scale in order to be effective. And I think that we have a number of potential strategies to help meet the needs of American families to save that we haven't really fully explored and that maybe raise somewhat lower set of issues and barriers.
All right, so the Treasury Department doesn't like prize-linked savings accounts. Lottery commissioners, they don't like the idea either. But up in Michigan, the one state where it's now legal, they like it fine. The Save to Win program has taken in $18 million in deposits this year. And two other states, Rhode Island and Maine, have just passed legislation to give PLS a try. Now, maybe you think this is a terrible idea. Maybe you think people ought to save money on their own. But you know what? We don't. People respond to incentives. And for a lot of us, the incentive to save for retirement, for emergencies, for whatever, is weak. Why? Well, because the payoff is abstract and it's too far in the future. It's the opposite of skewness. This dilemma doesn't just apply to saving money. Think of a school kid, third or fourth grader. You want me to do what? To bust my butt in school for 10 more years and then go to college? Just to get some job I probably won't even like? Or think about Crime and Punishment. If you look at the data, it turns out that the death penalty does not work as a crime deterrent. Why? Because as it's currently practiced, with the punishment waiting so far out in the future, through a maze of delays and appeals, the incentive simply isn't strong enough to stop me from pulling the trigger right now. Sometimes you need stronger incentives, or maybe just some good smoke and mirrors. That's kind of what a prize-linked savings plan could offer. In a country where it's easy to borrow your way to bankruptcy, where you can buy lottery tickets anytime you buy a loaf of bread, PLS is like a big neon billboard that turns a boring old savings account into an exaggeration of itself. Stick some money in here, it says, and you just might hit a big payday. And even if you don't, well, your money still belongs to you. I'll buy that for a dollar. Wouldn't you?
Freakonomics Radio is a co-production of WNYC, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Beret Lamb, whose lucky lottery number is 8. David Herman is our engineer, and he never seems to get lucky. Our executive producer is Colin Campbell. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and you'll get the next episode in your sleep. You can find more audio at Freakonomicsradio.com. And as always, if you want to read more about the hidden side of everything, go to the Freakonomics blog at nytimes.com.
The floor is lava!
Oops. Hey, life happens, which is why your favorite styles from Ashley are available in life-resistant, high-performance fabric with removable, machine-washable fabric slipcovers that make it easy to clean spills, dirt, and imaginary lava. For more mess and less stress, shop Ashley's high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.